What's up, people? My name's Akala. I'm a hip-hop artist from North London and co-founder of the Hip Hop Shakespeare Company. Today, we're going to be talking about exactly that, Hip Hop Shakespeare. What is the concept? What is the idea? What is hip-hop? What is Shakespeare? How much of our opinions and thoughts and feelings on these two entities is based on fact, and how much is based on perception and marketing, and how these two forces, artistic forces, can be used as a force for education, self-determination, inspiration, etc. Big up. How you guys doing this evening? You okay? Okay, very good. That was a medium rare response, but we'll get into it. So I'm going to talk about the Hip Hop Shakespeare Company for about the next 40 minutes, and then we'll have a conversation. But we're going to do a little more than that. There will be some audience participation, and we will touch on a few other subjects that I think relate to the larger discussion of art and language and literature and all of those kind of things, and how they impact our well-being, how they impact mental health, how they impact our sense of self. But before we do any of that, I've got a little challenge for you guys. It's a challenge that we always open the Hip Hop Shakespeare workshops with. I have a series of quotes, some quotes taken from my favourite hip hop songs, some quotes taken from my favourite Shakespeare plays and or sonnets. I'm going to read you these one-line quotes, and you are going to tell me whether you think they are from hip hop or Shakespeare by show of hands. Does that make sense? Okay. So my first one is, "The most benevolent king communicates through your dreams." The most benevolent king communicates through your dreams. If you think that's a hip-hop quote, raise your hand, please. If you think it's Shakespeare, raise your hand, please. So immediately we're torn, but about 60% towards hip-hop. That one is hip-hop. It's from a gentleman known as the RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan. I haven't picked any obscure, unknown hip-hop artists. If people in this room may not have heard of some of the people I picked, by the way, it's not because I'm cheating. But these are anyone, if you ask anyone who listens to rap, these are some of the most famous people. I haven't deliberately gone and picked some people that no one would have heard of to make a funny point. "Men would rather use their broken weapons than their bare hands." Men would rather use their broken weapons than their bare hands. If you think that's hip-hop, raise your hand, please. If you think that's Shakespeare, raise your hand, please. Okay, leaning towards Shakespeare. That is Shakespeare. It's from Othello. Well done. "Sleep is the cousin of death." Sleep is the cousin of death. If you think that's hip-hop, raise your hand, please. If you think that's Shakespeare, raise your hand, please. About 80% leaning towards Shakespeare. It's hip-hop. It's a gentleman known as Nas, Nasir Jones, probably one of the greatest MCs ever to come out of the States. To expand on the meaning of that, actually, what gives this, and it's a very famous rap quote, ironically, a lot of newer rappers have sampled. So if you talk to a lot of the younger generation of hip-hop listeners, they think The Game or Lil Wayne or some of these other rappers came up with this quote because they have sampled Nas's original line and used it in their raps. But what Nas means is it's double. It's the obvious metaphor of sleep having this similarity to death and the stillness and all of that. But it's also where Nas is from, Queensbridge, New York, a very rough part of New York. The slang meaning of the word to sleep, why you're sleeping, is to not pay attention. And to not pay attention in a neighborhood as violent and as rough as that is literally related to death. Does that make sense? So it's a double metaphor. "Welcome to hell, the threshold of death." Welcome to hell, the threshold of death. If you think it's hip-hop, raise your hand, please. If you think it's Shakespeare, raise your hand, please. Okay, about 50-50 on that one. That one's a gentleman known as Big Punisher. He's not William Shakespeare. He passed away, sadly, a few years ago, about 10 or 15 years ago, but he's a great MC as well. "Who inflicted this bitter sickness?" Who inflicted this bitter sickness? If you think it's hip-hop, raise your hand, please. If you think it's Shakespeare, raise your hand, please. So we've got about 99% Shakespeare for that one. Hate to break it to you, but it's a gentleman known as the Jizzer. Yeah, he's also from this group, the Wu-Tang Clan. So the Wu-Tang Clan, for those who don't know about them, the lead producer from the Wu-Tang Clan actually produces a lot of the music for the newer Quentin Tarantino film, so Kill Bill, and he's just done his first big film himself. His name's the RZA. So he's someone who's stepped out of hip-hop and stepped into kind of more Hollywood arena, but came from this group, the Wu-Tang Clan. "Being so great, I have no need to beg." Being so great, I have no need to beg. If you think it's hip-hop, raise your hand, please. think of Shakespeare, raise your hand, please. Okay, majority of us towards Shakespeare, about 60-40. By the way, people don't stop voting, by the way, just if you've got a couple wrong. That you don't get to do that. So let me test that again, right? You must vote in the hip-hop Shakespeare. It's a participatory democracy. Everyone has to have a say, right? So being so great, I have no need to beg. I'm watching, I'm keeping my eyes out for people who don't raise their hand. If you think that's hip-hop, raise your hand, please, again. Think it's Shakespeare, raise your hand, please. Okay, majority towards Shakespeare. That is Shakespeare. It's from Richard II. I am reckless what I do to spite the world. I am reckless what I do to spite the world. Hip-hop, raise your hand, please. Shakespeare, raise your hand, please. 50-50. That quote is from Macbeth. I am. To destroy the beauty from which one came. To destroy the beauty from which one came. Hip-hop, raise your hand, please. Shakespeare, raise your hand, please. Again, 50-50, pretty evenly torn. It's a gentleman known as Jay-Z. It's from a song called You Must Love Me. And he's talking about, I suppose, what you'd think that quote's about. He had, a lifestyle, pretty tumultuous lifestyle coming up in Marcy Projects in New York and was involved in some relatively unsavory things. And when he says, how could you destroy the beauty from which one came? He's talking about his mum, the pain he inflicted on his mother, getting involved in the lifestyle he was, but also his neighbourhood, his community, etc., his society. It means all of those things. Last couple. A dead bird flying through a broken sky. A dead bird flying through a broken sky. Hip-hop, raise your hand if you think that's a hip-hop quote, please. Shakespeare, raise your hand if you think that's a Shakespeare quote. Okay, majority towards hip-hop. That one is hip-hop. That's Nas again, Nasir Jones. And my last one. Maybe it's hatred I spew. Maybe it's food for the spirit. Maybe it's hatred I spew. Maybe it's food for the spirit. Hip-hop, raise your hand, please. Shakespeare, raise your hand, please. About 70%, 80% Shakespeare. Anyone heard of Eminem? That's a, yep. Eminem did a song with Jay-Z called Renegade. I reckon there's a couple of people in the audience that know this song. I could see the mumblings going on where that line comes from. Now the question is, why do we do that exercise? And don't feel bad if you got them all wrong or some of them wrong or whatever else. Obviously the point is you're supposed to get them wrong. We've done that exercise hundreds of times all over the world. We've done it with some of the leading exponents of Shakespearean literature down in London. I even did it with Sir Ian McKellen. I presume you all know who that is. If you don't, Gandalf from Lord of the Rings. Who was great. He hosted actually, when we officially launched the company, he co-hosted the workshop in East London with me and was great to work with. But even for him, it was an exposure to a whole world of literature, essentially, that he'd never seen before. And even he got some of the quotes wrong, right? So don't feel at all bad. He didn't get many wrong, I have to be honest. I'm not going to publicly claim that he got more wrong than he did. But he had a little test for how he deciphered which was hip-hop or Shakespeare, and we'll talk about what that was afterwards. But really, I suppose this exercise is about showing how our perceptions can often, which we're going to revisit, cloud our view of a particular set of things, how imagery can cloud our view of a particular set of things. And our view of art is not necessarily based on the quality of the art, but often it's based on the way we receive the art, or based on the way the art is written about, or based on the way the art is presented in the media, not based on the quality of what the people are producing. And of course, society is the same. You know, young kids from particular areas of Glasgow will be demonized in a way that young kids from another area of Glasgow will not be demonized. It doesn't matter what their behavior is. It doesn't matter how they carry themselves in life. You could have a kid from the Gorbals who's, you know, the next Albert Einstein, but being from the Gorbals or from somewhere like that, that person may not be looked at as the same way who's on their way to Eton or wherever else. Does that make sense? So our perceptions are very much clouded by society. And so we do this exercise to just show people right at the beginning, actually, what you think you know so much of, maybe you don't. But there are many other similarities between hip-hop and Shakespeare, beyond language. Any great forms of poetry have something more in common than just the physical words that they're using. But with Shakespeare particularly, more than many other poets, there's this rhythm. Does anyone know the rhythm that Shakespeare used most of the time? Yes, iambic pentameter. And iambic pentameter, for those who don't know, means five sets, two beats. Iam di dum. People, put your hand on your heart, please. Now, if your heart is in a perfect working order, it should hopefully beat in sets of two, and on and an offbeat. If it isn't, please consult your doctor. But that rhythm is intrinsic to music. Now, Shakespeare used this rhythm in all of the sonnets and in many of the plays, even though he experimented with it to various different degrees. But why is this significant and why does it relate to hip-hop? I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to show you. If we can play track two, please. Now, one, two. Everything I'm about to say is Shakespeare. It's not a rap. I haven't doctored it. I haven't changed it in any way. In fact, it's Shakespeare's most famous poem, Sonnet 18. It goes like this. You ready? Shout, I compare thee to a summer's day. Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's leaves have all too short a date. Sometimes too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of the fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in a shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe and eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. As men can breathe and eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. If we can hold it there, please, that beat. Now, what's interesting about this rhythm, if you have any young people who are into hip-hop or into grime, or not necessarily even young people actually, anyone who's into writing this form of lyricism that sits over music, they'll tell you that it's very difficult to write a lyric, a bar as we like to call it. Our stanza actually in hip-hop is 16 bars, Shakespeare's sonnets are 14. But it's very difficult to write a lyric that fits over a relatively slow beat like that, 70, 80 BPM, and then transfer it onto what we call grime, which is double that speed, 140 beats per minute. Usually you have to write a completely separate verse to sit on either one of the beats. Does that make sense? Because it's so much quicker, it's a completely different flow. What's interesting about the iambic pentameter is it does exactly that. Can we have track three, please? Listen. Shout, I compare thee to a summer's day. Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's leaves have all too short a day. Sometimes too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of the fair thou owest, nor shall death brag the wanderest in a shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe and eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. As men can breathe and eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. Thank you. Now, if you notice, I always have to repeat the last two lines of the sonnet twice because I'm so used to this 16-bar format that we have in hip-hop. It feels premature for me to end that at 14 bars. That's just the format that I've got used to. But I don't want you guys to trust me on this rhythm. We're actually going to put it to the test. So, this is Team A, and this is Team B, right? And what we're going to do now, Team A and B, is we're going to do a simple call and response. Team A, we're going to take a completely separate piece of Shakespeare. In fact, we're going to take the intro to Romeo and Juliet. Team A, I'm going to say the first line. You're going to repeat it back to me. Team B, I'm going to say the second line. You're going to repeat it back to me. Once we feel we roughly know where we're going, we're going to try and make a beat, and we're going to try and get some rhythm and feel the rhythm in these words, right? So the first line for you guys is, and say it with this rhythm. We will put a beat under it in a second. Two households both alike in dignity.
Two households both alike in dignity.
In fair Verona where we lay our scene.
In fair Verona where we lay our scene.
From ancient grudge break to new mutiny.
From ancient grudge break to new mutiny.
Where civil blood makes civil hands unclean.
Where civil blood makes civil hands unclean.
Two households both alike in dignity.
In fair Verona where we lay our scene.
From ancient grudge break to new mutiny.
Where civil blood makes civil hands unclean.
Now, do you reckon you know these lines yet? Or do you still need the call and response? If you've got a pen on you, I see some of you with pens. Feel free to make a little note, because I'm going to try and let you fly all by yourself and do it without my intervention. Let's try and add two more lines to the fold, right? So we're going to try and get to six lines, three lines each, right? So, two households both alike in dignity.
Two households both alike in dignity. In fair Verona, where we lay our scene. From ancient grudge break to new mutiny. Where civil blood makes civil hands unclean. From forth the fatal loins of these two foes.
Yeah, that one.
The alliteration makes that one pretty difficult. From forth the fatal loins of these two foes. From forth the fatal loins of these two foes. A pair of star-crossed lovers take their life. A pair of star-crossed lovers take their life. There's only two more lines left of the whole poem, so we might as well go for it. A pair of star-crossed lovers take their life, whose misadventures piteous overthrows. Whose misadventures piteous overthrows. Doth with the death bury their parents' strife. You can say does, you don't have to say doth. Does with the death bury their parents' strife. Okay, so now what we're going to do, you see I'm nodding my head? We're just going to, nice and quiet, not too loud, all of you, join in, clap at this speed. That's your beat, right? Now, call and response. Two households both alike in dignity. In fair Verona where we lay our scene. From ancient grudge break to new mutiny. Where civil blood makes civil hands unclean. From forth the fatal loins of these two foes. A pair of star-crossed lovers take their life. Whose misadventures piteous overthrows. Doth with the death bury their parents' strife. Keep clapping. Now, I'm going to count you in. You're going to get as far as you can get without my help. If you fail at line four, it's no big deal. Are you ready? Okay. One, two, three, four. Well done, give yourselves a big round of applause. Now actually, you guys did amazingly well. You got pretty much the whole thing down. But as you can see, that rhythm is so much there. And somehow, there's a tendency, and one of the reasons we did this, I suppose, part of the journey, was that as a young man or young boy going to school, I always loved poetry, but it always puzzled me how the curriculum, I don't think individual teachers, because I think that there are many brilliant individual teachers that feel very constrained by the curriculum and the way they have to teach. But how is it we can take something so beautiful, so musical, and make it boring? That's what always amazes me about school, because I loved poetry, and yet I hated a lot of my English classes in school. That was no diss to the teachers, because I had some really good English teachers. But what was it that was missing? And with Shakespeare particularly, it seems there's this massive tendency to forget that the guy wrote performance poetry. We spend so much time turning it into kind of an academic, turning him into some sort of intellectual deity that we forget this guy write poems for people to perform on a stage. So the first time you encounter Shakespeare should be performed, should be sung, should be rapped, should be acted. It shouldn't be written down in front of you and you analysing it. Because I guarantee if I took, I don't know, Led Zeppelin lyrics or Pink Floyd or Bob Marley or any great musician that people love, and I said, don't worry about the songs, sit down and read it first, people wouldn't enjoy it. If I gave you the lyrics to Redemption Song, which are wonderful poetic lyrics, without the music, without what it was that Bob decorated it with, it becomes just words on a page. That's not to diss poetry. There's fantastic written poetry and it's worthy of study as written poetry. But the entry point, even in the ancient world, many of these great ancient tales from the Iliad and the Odyssey to the epics of Sanjata, whatever they are, began life as oral tradition, began life as song, began life as storytelling. You know what I mean? The same with Celtic poetry here. You know, a lot of it is now in volumes, but it began as communities retelling their collective stories. And so many of the issues we try to surmount in schools and working with young people generally is these perceptions and all this baggage they have around who Shakespeare even was. You know, people always tell me he was posh. Well, received pronunciation,
didn't exist when Shakespeare was alive. So the Queen's English, this way of speaking that we're told is proper, the man who's credited as being the greatest writer in the English language never heard it. So for example, if you see in a lot of Shakespeare's works, the ends of words seem like they should rhyme, but today they don't because of the accent we have. So for example, you might see the end of a sonnet and there'll be the word mood and blood, which sounds similar but don't rhyme. But they did in Shakespeare's time. So the accent was like mood and blood, which one of my good friends, Ben Crystal, pointed out to me. His dad's a linguist, expert Shakespearean linguist, and they do performances in original pronunciation. And that's how people sounded, mood and blood. They would have spoke like that. It was nothing like what we're told is the appropriate way to speak English. Of course, Shakespeare experimented with grammar. He experimented with spelling. He'd done all the things, basically, we tell young people in class not to do. And there are still great artists continuing that tradition today. There's a Nobel Prize-winning author called José Saramago. And if you read any of his books, there's like a full stop every four pages. He doesn't use full, I don't know what's wrong with the guy, he just doesn't use full stops. Now, we'll tell young people in school, don't do that. This guy has thrown out all of the conventions of how we should use grammar, and he's won a Nobel Prize for it. His sentence is literally, you just comma after comma after comma, four pages in, and then he might put a full stop. What I'm saying is there's a difference between having some rules to a game within which you can play and constraining people's creativity. And often, the line between the two is blurred. Often, in fact, we go so far over to the other way and to passing tests and all these other things that schools are constrained by having to achieve that we're not encouraging people to be as creative as possible. And this is one of the things we've encountered with Shakespeare. Language, accent, Shakespeare invented loads of words that are today in the English language that we know, assassination being one of them. But then what about if we move to hip-hop? You know, what is it about hip-hop that, you know, in the media, even though you have, you know, the biggest selling computer games in the world are teaching you to kill people, literally, you know, literally. How many posters, if we just drive through the city centre, we drive through London, how many Hollywood posters are you going to see with someone with a gun on the cover, right? Apparently, when Hollywood does it, they're not promoting violence. When rappers do it, they are. Now, so there's this interesting double standard that rap is held out. Even the negative side of rap, that I might not necessarily love all of what comes out of that. When Shakespeare's talking about me and a guy had an argument and I chopped his head off, he means it. In his time, that's how people settled disputes. If your wife cheated on it, it was perfectly acceptable for you to behead her. So we romanticize even the past, we sanitize the past as if that wasn't what was going on. Shakespeare was a social commentator of his time. So when in Titus Andronicus, someone gets carved up and put in a pie and fed to their parents, well, maybe that really happened. That's the kind of stuff that was going on in those days. So to me, I'm not so much concerned necessarily even with whether or not a rap lyric is violent. I'm concerned with whether or not it's poetic. What is the quality of the poetry? What is the quality of the language? But one of the biggest problems we have affecting the way hip-hop is perceived or affecting our understanding of hip-hop, ironically, is history. African-American culture has produced so many different, wonderful, various forms of music, and it's almost as if the way in which they're presented is in a cultural and intellectual vacuum, because there is either so little understanding of the African societies they came from or such drastic misconceptions of those societies, it's hard for people to explain some of this music, some of this culture. But once we have a more accurate and holistic picture, it becomes very obvious why these people in this society produced the kind of music and kind of culture they did. So with that in mind, we're going to go on a little tour de force, very quick tour de force of African history, essentially, looking at some of the societies and looking at some of the culture in those places and then how they've influenced this character that today we call the MC. Or the rapper. So this is a picture right here. Does anyone want to guess where in the world this is and what year it is? Just a wild guess, sorry, go on. South America could be. Look closely at the city. As you can see, there's straight streets. There's a wall around the entire of the outside of the city. There's a few story buildings at the back. The year of this picture is 1668. Egypt's a good guess. The year of this picture is 1668. It was drawn by a Dutchman called Olfert Dapper. And this is a city called Luango in the Congo. So this is, as you can see, generally our perception of what the Congo was like in this period of time and what was going on. Maybe isn't reflected by the reality. But this is the city of Luango in 1668. This, drawn by the same man who traveled across Africa at the time, Olfert Dapper. This is Benin, in what today would be Nigeria. Again, if you look closely, well, you can see the buildings in the foreground and the procession of the king. But if you look in the back, again, the city has a wall around it. Now, what's interesting about this wall
is that this wall is actually in the Guinness Book of Records, 1974 edition, as largest earthworks carried out prior to the mechanical era. Archaeologists excavated this wall, and the wall, wait for it, in case you think I've stumbled, the wall in total has 10,000 miles of walling. 10,000 miles, easily on a scale comparable to the Great Wall of China, for example. So you could speak of the Great Wall of Benin. Of course, it's in tatters now, but the foundations and things like that that are there, it's 10,000 miles. So it gives you, again, a sense of the scale. There is another another wonder of Western Africa, actually in Southwest Nigeria, called Songbo Eredo. It is a moat. It's 20 meters wide, 70 meters deep, and it's dug around an ancient city of 400 square miles. It's actually the largest monument, technically, on the African continent, even larger than the Great Pyramids of Egypt, in the sense that it took 1 million more tons of cubic earth to be removed than it did to build the Great Pyramid. Now, to give you a sense of how large 400 square miles is, London today is about 600 square miles. So imagine 1,000 years ago, which is when it was built, someone's dug a moat around the whole of London, 70 meters deep. That's roughly what we're dealing with. If we go on, this is the kind of art that people were producing in this period of time. This is metal, this is brass. This is actually in the British Museum, this piece. You can go and see it. This is also in the British Museum, these pieces. They're from a collection called the Benin Bronzes. So again, this is metal art, some of the finest metal art in the world. They're about this big, so they're not very small, they're huge. If you go and see them in the British Museum, they're literally like almost human size. I've been to this place, actually. This is a place known as Great Zimbabwe, in Zimbabwe. I went there 2011. The outer wall, this gives you a sense of how big it is. The outer wall is 100,000 tons of granite bricks, held together without any cement or mortar at all. Again, how they did it, I don't know. But this gives you a sense of scale. This is a night, you know, again, because many of us growing up, we watch Tarzan films, and whether or not we believe things, certain stereotypes go in. But this was the kind of way, or outfits, attire, a warrior from this part of Africa 500-600 years ago would have been wearing. Not a loincloth with a spear, but as you can see, he's wearing quilted armor. Again, this quilted armor is in the British Museum. There's an example of it. He's a knight from what's called the Kanem Borno Empire. Again, some metal art. This is from a Nigerian kingdom called Ile Ife. Again, this is cast out of metal. If you look how fine the detail is on it. This is the head of a ruler from one of those kingdoms. Now, what is significant about this ruler? Can anyone notice something about this person? Yeah, it's a woman. One of the things that is interesting about a lot of these pre-colonial African societies is that for women to rule wasn't considered particularly strange. Whether we talk about ancient Egypt, where there were five female pharaohs, where we talk about Nubia, where there was a whole line of queens called the Candaces, or even here in Western Africa, where you had women running societies or women in the army, none of that was considered abnormal. So there was a certain, not saying there was no sexism, let me be clear, I'm just saying there was a certain expectation that women would have a certain degree of political power. And that's continued actually in a lot of the New World. Many of the leaders of rebellions, where my family's from in Jamaica, for example, were women. If you look on a Jamaican $500 bill, people call it a nanny, because the woman on it is called Nanny of the Maroons. She was a military general and she was a woman, and that wasn't considered at all strange in that culture. This is from northern Nigeria, a place called Zaria in Hausa land, again, 500-600 years old. This is drawn by a British explorer called Dr. Henry David Bath. This is the city of Agades in the Songhai Empire. At the time, 500-700 years ago, this city had a population of around 70,000 people. And the population of London in this time was between 25,000 to 50,000. So that gives you a sense of just how large for its period of time this city was. But this wasn't the largest city in Western Africa. This was. This is a mosque, the Mosque of Djenne in Timbuktu, which is now in the country that's called Mali. But the ancient kingdom of Mali was much larger than the country Mali today. In fact, the ancient kingdom of Mali was about the size of Western Europe. So it was a very, very large kingdom. Some other shots of, this is the inside, what it looks inside. Another shot from outside. These two gentlemen here, this is a very famous map. This map was actually in the Daily Telegraph a few weeks ago, because the gentleman on your left is a king known as Mansa Musa. And according to this study that was published in the Daily Telegraph, I'm not sure I necessarily agree with the study, but this is just to give you a sense of the scale of wealth. They estimate that this gentleman, Mansa Musa I, when adjusted for inflation, is the richest human being to have ever lived. He traveled to Egypt and he gave away so much gold that it took about 10 years for the price of gold and the Egyptian stock market to stabilize. So he's a very wealthy gentleman. The gentleman on the other side is the ruler of the Moors at the time. Another myth that seems to be perpetrated is that people didn't have writing 600 or 700 years ago in that part of the world. This is one private family's collection of writing in Mauritania. There's many families across Mauritania that have literally thousands of manuscripts from anything from 1100 to 700-800 years ago. This is the largest collection of books in that region of the world. This is back to the Library of Timbuktu. There are in fact 700,000 books surviving from that period of time, from the 9th century to the 12th or 13th and 14th century in that region of Western Africa. And what's very interesting is you have things like this. Michael Palin presented this in a documentary called Sahara. Does anyone know what that is? The phases of the moon. Now, the problem with this is, this manuscript is about 200 years older than the birth of Galileo or Copernicus. So can you see it presents us with a problem? I'm not saying those gentlemen necessarily copied that, because I don't think they did. What I'm saying is that the history of mathematics and science hasn't incorporated this into the way it's traditionally written. And that's not me saying that, that's Michael Palin saying that. Just in case anyone wants to, you know, it actually says that at the bottom, all of what Michael Palin said. And that's about the end of what we're saying. Now, so what's interesting about these cultures, that gives you a sense of the level of sophistication. But what I'm interested in is the actual practical day-to-day realities of the societies. And as a general rule, pretty much without exception, these societies were organized on the basis of caste, but caste according to occupation. So you'd have the blacksmith caste, you'd have a certain amount of families that were blacksmiths, you'd have a certain amount of families that were leather workers, you'd have a certain amount of families that were, and this is what I'm concerned with, in fact, one of my friends is a direct descendant of one of these families, and they're called griots. The griots are poets, singers, historians, genealogists. So even though you had all of this written literature, the most sacred ideas, the most spiritual, esoteric knowledge of the society, the history of the society, even the legitimacy of rulership was hosted in this character called the griot, who was all of these things, a poet, a singer, a musician. They had a formal process of study, usually 21 years, 7 years for singing, 7 years for speech, 7 years for musicianship. Now, this was a very widespread culture, generally throughout most of Africa. And once we understand that, and we understand this focus of who the griot was and what the traditions were, it becomes much easier to understand why you see certain musical traditions in Brazil, why you see certain musical traditions in Jamaica and America and all these different places. But if we don't understand this basis, it's kind of like trying to understand Bruce Lee without understanding the Chinese martial arts that gave birth to him. He may have been born in America, but there's thousands of years of development of that culture prior to Bruce Lee that need to be understood if we want to understand that culture. And so I suppose the way these cultures flowered in the New World is very interesting. There's a place called Congo Square in New Orleans, which is where jazz is officially supposed to have been born, the birthplace of jazz music. This was a place that, even during the 17th and 18th century, the Africans who were enslaved in the Americas had the day off, Sunday off, which may not seem radical today, but for the time it was. So on Sundays, these people would gather around, hundreds of them in many cases, beating drums, reciting their music and poetry and all these different traditions. And eventually this neighborhood gave birth to what we call jazz music. Even amongst the young people who listen to rap today, there's a mythology that rap was invented in the 70s. But if you go back and listen to Cab Calloway or the Golden Gate Quartet, who's a jazz quartet from the 20s and 30s, I mean, literally you can go onto YouTube and see them rapping in the 1930s. So why are we told, even people who think they know about rap, young people who love rap, they don't seem to realize that people have been rapping since forever. The idea that rhythmically rhyming over the beat of a drum started happening 40 years ago is a little bit absurd. So you have there in Congo Square, that tradition. You have in Brazil, the traditions that have influenced so greatly Rio Carnival and Salvador Carnival. And even in the northeast of Brazil, where I was lucky enough to travel, the Yoruba religion is the primary religion of that region. It's very visible. You have in Jamaica, the Jamaican sound system culture and that's produced reggae music and all of those things. And then where these traditions meet back up in New York in the 1970s is what gives us what we know as hip hop. And without understanding all of that genealogy, the idea that you could compare hip hop to Shakespeare to some people sounds blasphemous. Once you understand what I mean when I say hip hop, what I mean when I say an MC, the tradition that I'm talking about, which let's be clear, the people who created hip hop, Afrika Bambaataa, Grandmaster Flash, Cool DJ Herc, even when they named hip hop, they understood exactly what they were doing. The word hip in the hip hop comes from the Wolof verb hippie. Wolof is a West African language, primarily spoken in Senegal today. And the word hippie, or the verb hippie, means to open your eyes and see. It's a term of enlightenment. Hop, from the English, signifying movement. Thus, the definition of hip-hop is intelligent movement. as anyone, again, who's a deep fan of hip-hop will tell you, KRS-One has a whole song about this concept. So nothing I'm saying, I don't want to pretend that anything I'm saying is new or original or hip-hop artists haven't spoken about this stuff before. I'm merely continuing that presentation. But of course, if all we see is MTV and BET and all this other mainstream instant gratification, materialistic culture that is surrounding rap music, as KRS-One says, rap is something you do, hip-hop is something you live. Hip-hop is a way to view the world. So when understood in that culture, it becomes very clear how and why these two cultures can be married again. So then to reflect on my own personal experience and how I got to this point, and what relevance I think this has to, I suppose, personal, mental, social well-being, when I was 12 or 13 years old, I was from a background that, you know, stereotypically is supposed to be a little bit rough, you know, single-parent family, we didn't have a whole lot of money, blah, 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 all these kind of things. What I did have, though, on the other side, the flip side of that, was exposure to culture. My stepdad ran the Hackney Empire Theatre, which is a famous African-Caribbean-led theatre in East London, in what's quite a rough part of East London. I'm not from Hackney, but I spent a lot of time there. And I was exposed to a lot of sound system culture. But more than anything, when I got to 12 and 13, and that sort of age group, and I was trying to find my own place as a young man, there's a group that came out that have influenced me more than any other musical entity called the Wu-Tang Clan, right? And I'm being deadly serious. When I was 12 or 13, the Wu-Tang made it literally sexy to be intelligent. It was unbelievable. Like, they would use words like benevolent in a rap song, you know, and we'd go into school and we'd start writing lyrics. And the bigger the words you could use, the more eloquent you could sound, the more you'd be seen as a good MC. Now, what's so interesting about the Wu-Tang is they were from a really rough part of New York, one of the roughest parts of New York, Stapleton Projects. Many of them had been shot. Some of them had been to prison. All of the cliche rap stories, yet they didn't distance themselves from that and pretend they didn't come from that and try and be somebody they weren't. But they also didn't play down their intelligence and act stereotypically. There was a real balance in the group. There's a member called ODB. I'm not going to tell you what that stands for, right? And then there's the RZA, who they call the Abbot, who's the guy who's gone on to work with Quentin Tarantino, but is also the one who writes, the one who's the most philosophical character in the group. So you had this kind of gamut of personalities that literally made it fashionable for a generation of young men from a particular environment to be clever without changing who they were. And I would say genuinely that hip-hop, and I know I speak for many people of my generation, hip-hop, I don't want to say saved my life, but I don't know if that would be an exaggeration. At 12 or 13 years old, when I felt alienated by the school system, when I felt like I wanted to drop out of school, when I had a hard relationship with teachers, when I had trouble at home with my mum or whatever else, when I was going through all of these things, I'd listen to a Wu-Tang record or to a Public Enemy record or whatever else it was, and I'd find solace in that poetry. You understand? And I'd find a sense of self-worth that people like me could be clever. You know, if you're from the rough part of town or whatever else, if you never see people like you presented in an intellectual manner, and the same is true up here, you know, if you're consistently referred to as a chav and a hoodie and whatever else, and you never see anybody like you being presented as if they have the right to be intelligent, as if they have the right to be the custodian of intelligence, you'll feel alienated, you think, forget. And this affects severely your mental health, the way you carry yourself, the way you're going to conduct yourself in society. I mean, I've seen on firsthand young men of my generation, I do a lot of work in prisons as well. The difference between someone who goes into prison, comes into contact with knowledge in prison, and someone who doesn't. And the transformational power of knowledge. And that was very evident in the Wu-Tang Clan, as I said, because they came from this particular environment. In fact, I'm going to read you a little bit, or tell you a little bit of one of the poems, just to give you a sense of what the kind of science the Wu-Tang were dealing with, even back then. This is a poem by that man, the RZA. It's actually a rap. It's called 12 Jewels. And it starts a little sign like this. I'm only going to give you a little bit of it. But this will give you a sense of how overtly and openly intellectual hip-hop culture was being in that period of time. He says, in the pre-existence of the mathematical biochemical equations and manifestations of rock, plant, air, fire, and water without their basic formations, solids, liquids, and gases that cause the land masses and the space catalysts and all matter that exists and is dense. In the third dimension, you must observe a physical comprehension. It takes a nerve to be struck. Wisdom is the wise pursuing to wake up, the dumb who've been sleeping. The fourth dimension is time. When it goes inside your mind, when the shackles energize up through the back of your spine. So observe, as my chi energy strikes your vital nerve, one swerve of the tongue pierces like a sword through the lung. Have you not heard that words kill as fast as bullets when you load negative thoughts from the chamber of your brain and your mouth pulls the trigger that propels wickedness straight from hell, from the pits of your stomach where negativity dwells? And this is a famous rap that RZA wrote and we all knew as young people when we were reciting. In fact, RZA's partner, the GZA, the genius, is right now, as we speak, working with one of the leading physicists at MIT in America to make an album called Dark Matter about teaching young people physics. And I don't suppose it's just for young people, but this is what Wu-Tang were all about. And so in conclusion, I suppose I've been fortunate enough to be exposed to the reality of what hip-hop really is, not just the television's definition of what it is, but be on the ground in hip-hop culture, be surrounded by the actual poetry of it, and be in the theatre. And I feel that as a young man, as a young person, or formerly young, you know, I don't know where I fit in that scheme right now, but I feel like exposure to that, and I see this in our work with Hip Hop Shakespeare, bringing it back to that, where we have gone all over the UK and all over the world now, working with young people that are supposedly hard to reach, that are supposedly difficult, supposedly terrible, even some of the young people we work with in prisons. How is it we can get them to listen and want to even learn about Shakespeare? What is it about the way that Shakespeare is being presented to them that all of a sudden it now becomes interesting, it becomes accessible, it becomes something they feel okay about being a part of? See, if I'm a person and I feel patronized by you, and I'm not saying that individuals necessarily do this, but I'm saying that societally, the way knowledge is presented, sometimes particularly in the inner city, if I feel patronized by the knowledge, I'm going to reject it. If I feel like I'm being told what to do or being disciplined or being undermined, particularly if I'm from a rough place where at home I might not be getting any of that, I'm not going to listen to you. I'm going to reject what you're doing. Whereas if I feel loved, if I feel included, if I feel like this is for me and it's relevant to me, then I'm gonna engage with it. And I suppose that's what we try to do. We're not against the harder intellectual endeavors of writing dissertations on these things and taking examinations and all of those things. We just have a different philosophy about how we should reach that goal and believe that we're in a period of time now where throughout the world, particularly post-industrial societies, there's a real dialogue going on about what's education even for? We're no longer training masses of workers to go and work in factories. So what is the purpose of education? What are we trying to give people? What kind of understanding, what kind of human beings is education trying to create? And it seems to me we haven't reached a conclusion about that discussion, and we'd just like to be a small part of pushing that discussion forward. Thank you very much.